Listeners, whether or not you're an ambitious ad exec trying to raise your son on your own in New York City, chances are you appreciate any service that can both provide you with an excellent premium product and simplify your life at the same time. Which is why I'm here to tell you about Sparkplug Coffee. If you're a coffee lover, you know that the secret to the best coffee is fresh roasted beans. Well, Sparkplug Coffee is custom roasted when you order it and delivered to you within a week. Sparkplug uses only premium Arabica beans that are directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer lots of roasts, blends, and grinds to choose from, including decaf and half-calf, and even a rotating feature blend for you adventurous types. And Sparkplug offers autopilot, set-it-and-forget-it delivery so that you'll never be caught without fresh coffee again. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen, so plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Etc.
Top 100 Project
and action.
Hello and welcome to the Next 100 Project, the weekly podcast that reviews whatever movies we damn please. Hit that pause button and listen to us later if spoilers get under your skin, because we like to spoil movies. I am Ryan Ellis with my very married wife because she already, quote-unquote, found herself, Bev.
That's me.
All right, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Kramer vs. Kramer. It was number one at the domestic box office in 1979. What's the next instance of a Best Picture Oscar winner also leading the pack as the biggest box office attraction of its year?
It didn't happen again for almost 20 years, 15 years, Forrest Gump.
No.
What?
Rain Man, also starring Dustin Hoffman.
Oh my god, you know, I was looking up the movies and I didn't even check, because I just completely assumed that Rain Man was fine, but I never would have guessed that it'd be a number one movie.
Number one
Rain
Man. Yeah, 9 years later. Hoffman won awards both times, Best Actor, and he had the biggest hit of the year, and it was the Best Picture of the year.
Good on him, but man, I could not be more surprised.
Well then, let me unsurprise you with some facts. The Next 100 Project's sixth movie, Kramer vs. Kramer, was nominated for AFI's 1998 and 2000 Top 100 lists, but of course, did not make it. Columbia Pictures released it on December 19, 1979. Produced on a pretty small budget, KVK raked in gigantic amounts of money. So, Bev, explain the divorce and custody drama movie for people who don't know what this one is about.
Meryl Streep is Joanna Kramer, a dutiful housewife in late 1970s New York, who flees her family. Dustin Hoffman is her husband, Ted, an advertising executive who spends more time at the office than at home. Justin Henry plays their son, Billy. Once the two males are left to fend for themselves, they develop a loving relationship until Joanna returns and fights for custody of Billy.
Very simple story, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
In a nutshell, sad matriarch's change of heart brought on by wallpaper discrepancy. Or, Bev, don't get any ideas. Run off and
leave you with the dogs.
Leave me with the dogs. Okay, so a few more numbers before we get into the body of the podcast. Rotten Tomatoes critics, 88% of them are fans, 36 fresh, 5 rotten, 89% of audiences. The movie remains 144th on a Box Office Mojo adjusted for inflation list. That's more money than Psycho or Pretty Woman. That's pretty surprising, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. People often cite Kramer vs. Kramer and its success at the box office as evidence that society is just being dumbed down and turned childish because people used to go out to the theater to see movies like Kramer vs. Kramer or Rain Man is another good example. But now a movie like this would never, ever be the biggest hit of the year. Although, you know what? Last year's biggest hit was American Sniper. And I'm not saying it's Kramer vs. Kramer, but it's also not Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah.
It's not a childish movie and it's not a dumb movie.
Mm-hmm. Last year, actually, now we're talking 2 years ago.
Sorry. Oh my gosh.
I know what you meant, though.
Time goes by so quickly.
That's true. We've made clear that Kramer vs. Kramer was number one in 79. Apocalypse Now, the AFI movie, and the better movie, really, between the two, was fourth at the box office that year. Okay, so we've got one of the most real and naturalistic movies that ever made a killing and won Oscars. We both like the movie, I know that, but let's hear what you have to say right now.
Kramer vs. Kramer just guts me. It moves me. Without any cheap tricks, but with just this heartbreakingly sincere script and phenomenal performances. The film's going to turn 37 this year, and while it feels anachronistic because the world has changed significantly since it was made, it doesn't feel dated. It's a really honest, beautiful story told with pathos and artistry, if only we could find a way to approach all of society's touchy topics with such nuance.
and it's fair to both parents. In fact, I think you have to side with Ted, mostly once he becomes a great dad. He's obviously not a very good dad or husband in the early part of the film. We never see any of that, though. It's all based on hearsay. He doesn't even deny it, though. Mm-hmm. And one of the great moments in the film is when the court case is happening and he admits, I wasn't there for her, I wasn't really there for my son, but I'm a changed person. And also that wonderful moment when the lawyer, his lawyer, is all over Joanna saying you failed the longest relationship you ever had in your life, your marriage, right? 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 And she doesn't want to admit that. The camera cuts to Dustin Hoffman saying, no, you didn't.
But we don't even need to have them say it out loud in the courtroom because, and this is part of what makes this film so good, all that information is right in the very first scene when he comes home from work and she leaves him. It would be so easy to turn her into the villain. Any audience would normally automatically side with Ted because what kind of a mother abandons her child? But her performance is so nuanced and you can see the desperation and the fear and the panic in her eyes as she's so desperate to walk out the door that she even leaves her suitcase behind. But you also see in his performance how much he overlooks her, how much he's in his own world and doesn't see what's going on in his own home. We see, you know, a couple scenes later that he doesn't even know what grade his son is in. We come to understand how a situation like that could drive a woman so crazy that she just has to walk away or lose her mind. She might be close to killing herself, suicide, and she figures better to physically just leave him than to leave him by killing myself. So right off the bat, as an audience member, you can't really choose sides. The real villain is just society and the expectations that were placed on them. And I'm saying the word, I'm gonna bring out my feminist lexicon. The real villain is the patriarchy. And the patriarchy hurts everybody, not just women who have to give up their jobs and their dreams and never have an identity of their own, but also men who have their identity thrust upon them too. He has to be this ambitious ad exec that he doesn't even get to experience being a father and get to know his own child. If she hadn't left him, he would have missed out on this incredibly fulfilling and rich relationship with his son.
That he gets without his desiring to get it.
No, he doesn't know he wants it until he has it. He grows so much as a person.
And the whole last part of the movie is him fighting to keep
something
he didn't want when the movie started. There's a lot of motifs in this film. The first image after the credits is Meryl Streep's conflicted face looking down at Billy in the bed. The last is Ted's as the elevator closes on him. You could say that that's the kid's favorite in each case. At the beginning it's the mother, the end it's the father. Joanna also says in the beginning, I'm not taking him with me when she's leaving. And then she says at the end in that very emotional scene, I'm not going to take him with me. Maybe not the exact same words, but the same sentiment.
What a great touch in the script, I'm not taking him with me, because it expresses right there how much has changed in the course of the film, that you react to that line in completely different ways in the beginning and the end.
And the elevator is also a key moment because she's going down the elevator when she says that line, and at the end she's going back up. The elevator closes on her face when she's leaving, and it closes on his face when she's going back up at the end to not say goodbye to Billy. She'll have a relationship with this kid. Presumably they're going to be cool with each other, and maybe in 5 to 10 years they'll each get remarried and they'll invite each other to their weddings. You see that in movies, you hear about that in real life, where exes sometimes can be friends because of the kid and even because they just like each other enough. There are other great recurring motifs, the French toast, the beginning and at the end, the two males pee the same way. And this isn't recurring, but you gotta love the two moments where Ted puts Joanna's picture on Billy's nightstand. Mm. The kid had hidden it away in his drawer, and Ted deliberately puts it out and says, no, you can have this. And it's never commented on. The kid never says anything about the next day or anything. And then the infamous ice cream fight. We're not parents. We've never been there before. We've seen enough of this with our nieces, nephews, and other kids in our lives to know it's so real. Don't you get that chair. Don't you take the ice cream out of that freezer. Don't you put that spoon in that ice cream. One more step. Don't do anything else.
And it's so real that kids, when they're hurt by something in their life, will act out in a way that seems completely unrelated. That's the big fight, the big conflict between the two of them, but it also leads to the most cathartic moment in the movie when he comes to apologize to Billy in his bed. They finally hug and they finally have this real parent-child bond that feels warm.
They never fight again either.
That's right, they never fight again. From that moment on, Billy behaves himself, but Ted is also a patient and very affectionate, loving father. Mm. That's the big turning point in the film. And like you said about the picture, there's lots of little moments as you're describing the motifs. Part of the strength of this film is it never broadcasts its message and the story. It has a lot of really good, subtle visual storytelling that is incredibly effective. And that moment when he takes a picture of Joanna out of the drawer and puts it on, it's really touching. There are just so many moments that make anybody with good parents just so super grateful for all of the emotional generosity that parents give to their kids all the time.
You're a child of divorce.
I am a child of divorce.
Does this movie strike you more? It probably does, than it would me. I'm not a child of divorce.
The circumstances of my parents' divorce are dramatically different from this movie, but I would say that the circumstances that led to their marriage being doomed are exactly the same as Kramer versus Kramer. My parents are roughly the same age as Ted and Joanna would have been, and as a matter of fact, I think Billy would be about the same age as my oldest sister. They had those exact same societal constructs placed on them. I think it suited my dad okay to be ambitious at work and be more about his job than a kind of active family man. I mean, he was a really good dad in every way that was appropriate for the 70s and 80s, that was expected of him. He filled that role very much. My mother was like Joanna. I think that she never once wondered what she wanted her life to be and what kind of person that she was and wanted to become. She just did everything she was told, and there was a point, more when we were adolescents and we could look after ourselves a lot more, but there was a point where she had just had enough. I lived with both my mom and my dad after they split up. We also have a member of our family, my brother-in-law, who was raised by his father for the most part in very different circumstances, but we've seen these kinds of things in our own family, so I think I can probably say I have the authority to confirm how authentic this situation is in Kramer versus Kramer, how real it feels and how much I can relate to what's going on in it.
Did your mother paint clouds downtown?
No.
No clouds on the wall?
Well, we were so grown up by then. I don't think we wanted her to paint clouds on our walls by then. No.
Well, in the movie, Ted is super dad. Or when it's a woman doing all this and making it work, sometimes having a job, often having a job, especially in maybe the last 20 or 30 years. Hey, since this movie came out, that became more common for women to do those things. Then it's not just super mom, it's mom. I was raised by a more present mother than father, but that's the way it was. We've talked about this a lot of times, that in this era, our mothers both were given a role. They maybe didn't want that role, but they were the ones that took care of the house. My mom had a few part-time jobs here and there, so did yours. But the dads were the breadwinners. They had to bring home the bacon, and they had to cook it too, as Ted says in this. Well, no, they didn't have to cook it too, in our cases. So I understand and sympathize with them to a big extent, actually, because those were the jobs. But things have changed so much now, it's not the same kind of deal. In our lives, we don't have kids, we never will have kids. I am closer to being the housewife than you are.
Yeah, that's, we both that's have jobs, really accurate.
I do more cooking than you do because I'm able to do it. I am home in the early evening while you're just coming home around that time. It makes more sense for me to do that kind of stuff. I take care of house stuff as much as you do, if not more, because I'm retentive and just want it to be done a certain kind of way.
And there's things that just you are more fond of taking care of, and there are things that I'm more fond of taking care of. And it's funny how, without really feeling conflicted about letting the division of labor work out this way, it just happens I tend to gravitate towards things that are, I guess, the more like guy types of jobs. I take care of the dogs. I'm definitely more likely to be the one to deal with any professionals that we need for the house. I do our taxes, stuff like that. Although you do all the yard work too. Gosh, you do a lot, dear.
I really do. I truly do. Like the characters in our movie, I lived in a condo for a long time. I didn't have to do any of the yard work. I don't think I missed it from when I was a kid and I had to take care of it on my parents' acre of property on the country. But once we came here and we had to take care of a backyard and a front yard, right away I kind of enjoyed it. So it's become something I take pride in as much as obligation to do it.
And even the notion that we actively tried to have an even distribution of labor between us and the care of the home is progress. We look at our marriage, which is pretty egalitarian. We look at our friends who are parents and, like you said, our nieces and nephews and the homes that we see children who are being raised by parents who are in our generation. And it is completely different than what our parents, who were very much like Ted and Joanna. Fathers are incredibly involved. They have these rich relationships with their children. Mothers are not overwhelmed by their duties that leave them very little choice of what they want to do with their life. There are lots of choices. There are lots of different ways to make a family. There's lots of respect for families doing it whatever way works best for them, no matter what roles you think they should be assigned.
So is this a feminist movie?
In my opinion, yes. Even though somebody might look at it and say, but you clearly take the man's side in this court case. You don't side with the mother. You intrinsically feel like he should have custody of Billy and that it's a miscarriage of justice. Which, by the way, many family lawyers at the time said that was an absolute miscarriage of justice and that's not how the courts would have settled that case.
There was a stereotype, though, that around this time, and even when we were in our teens, that unless the woman was an addict, she was going to get custody of any
kids. Yes, you would have to be a really bad mom to lose custody of your children. That is not the case anymore. As a matter of fact, you would have to be a really bad dad to not get full joint custody. That's kind of the standard now, and it's amazing progress. So, is this a feminist film? Yes, because it is a feminist notion that men are just as capable of caring for children as women are.
A line said by Ted in the courtroom.
Yes, absolutely. When he takes on that job, he is perfectly capable of it. It's not about a woman striking out on her own. It's about a man proving life can be just as fulfilling and he can have just as much passion for his family as a woman can. And I think that's a feminist notion. It's a progressive notion. The popularity of this film and its effect on culture may be part of the reason why you and I have an egalitarian marriage. This film and its intelligence and its effectiveness could have been part of the consciousness that helped move this idea forward.
You know, one reason why advertising is such a common job in movies, and that's a stereotype that it is, it's a kind of job where you will work late and you have to do a lot of schmoozing, so you may not get home till 8 or 9 o'clock at night, if not later. Welcome to Hollywood.
Yes.
And welcome to then, and still it's true now, at least in terms of power jobs. But back in the 70s, it was more true about every job, where the man was the one in that job more than the women were. And if you were married as a Hollywood person, actor, executive, director, writer, whatever you were, then you had a wife who was at home taking care of kids, if there were any. You probably had servants who could do it too, granted, if you're rich. But anyway, the point was that you were the Ted and Joanna stereotype that we see in the film. This is one time where Hollywood got it right. They lecture us lots and lots. I've said this on other podcasts that we've done about how Hollywood will go on about how you've got to be there for your kids, show for that play, be there, be present, be important in their lives. And yet these people work 16-hour days regularly.
Mm-hmm.
But this movie shows that this guy can have the imperfect balance of work and family. He does manage to make it work, but that's by taking a different job, making less money. He does get fired too. It isn't his choice to leave the company he's with when the movie starts. But he's willing to put that aside to get what he wants. Some happiness at work, maybe not the same kind of happiness and potential for great advancement, but combined with a good family life.
And they have that great scene where he's listing the pros and cons of fighting for custody for Billy. In the cons, he has no social life, you know, all the things that he had to give up.
He doesn't write anything in the pros at all.
No, but the pros, he looks at the pros list and then he just goes...
It's the blonde kid on the floor.
It could be so corny. I feel like describing these scenes doesn't begin to do them justice because it doesn't express just how authentic and moving their performances are. So that when he goes to that bed and he hugs Billy, you can feel all of the passion and the desperation of a parent's love and the parent's desire to keep their child with them.
The method acting thing came out big time here for Hoffman because he's playing about as close to an ordinary person as he had at that point in his career, and maybe even since this movie came out. He's coming off of being divorced himself.
That's right.
And then he really bonded with Justin Henry, who plays Billy, to the point where they talk about on the making of documentary in the DVD, where's my Dustin? I need my Dustin.
Oh.
And the kid was an inexperienced actor, so Dustin was making Justin need him and want him as this father figure, even though he's just an actor working with him for 8 or so hours a day.
He was going through a divorce when he agreed to do the film. They made changes to the script to reflect his actual experience to, I guess, make it more easy for him to really get into the role.
And he co-wrote to the point where he probably should have got credit. They talk about this also in that making of. And Hoffman said, kind of with a bit of bemusement, maybe like, I wish I'd just taken the writing credit. He said he didn't want it at the time, but then the movie did win for writing, so he could have won. I think it's never happened before where an actor won for both writing and acting in the same movie. Certainly it's happened where an actor has been nominated for those two categories, but never, I don't think.
And he admitted that projection or that method acting made him actively hate Meryl Streep while they were on set. Apparently when he throws the wine glass in the restaurant, that was an improv. He just got so riled up with the anger that he was experiencing going through his own divorce that he had that improv. Her reaction is genuine because she's afraid and apparently she was really mad about it.
I've seen this movie plenty of times, so I was looking for that moment when he's playing with his wine glass. I don't think he ever even drinks out of it. But he moves it around a little bit. He actually puts it in a place where he couldn't have batted it off the table. So he was obviously thinking about doing this before it even happened.
Hmm.
And then he pulls it in such a position, and then before he walks away, it's bang! Yes, Meryl Streep does have that sort of like, what the fuck was that about type
yeah.
And yes, when they said cut, she was upset about that. But talk about getting a great reaction out of her.
Oh, yeah.
And a shot to see this wine glass just get obliterated on the wall.
And he takes such a left turn in that scene because initially he's being pretty kind and forgiving to her. His transition of becoming a real father has also made him turn his sympathies towards her because perhaps he can relate to what she was experiencing and how isolating it could have been for her. But he turns on a dime when she threatens to take Billy away from him.
That's the only time he is mean to her, yeah. though, when she comes back into the picture, because as I said, in the courtroom scenes, he's pretty wonderful with her. So maybe the movie's more sympathetic towards the guy because it's written by guys, it's starring a guy and a big power player at the time, Dustin Hoffman. But it's still pretty fair to the lady, at least.
Just about every Hollywood movie then and still now is made by men and starring men. So not much has changed in that respect.
But then, like we said last week, and we'll talk about this more next week because we'll be doing an Oscar preview show, I think it's 7 women are nominated for Best Picture this year, meaning they're the producer of a film of the 8 nominees.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's something that changed. The Sting, which we covered last week, Julia Phillips was the first ever woman to be nominated in 1973, and obviously the first ever to win. And not that many in the years that followed, that I recall, were nominated as Best Producer of the Year. Well, it's Best Picture, but you know what I'm saying. More so in the last 10 or 15 years, that's happened. Let's save those thoughts for next week because we're going to talk about racism, we're going to talk about sexism, we're going to talk about those kinds of issues along with the actual year in movies. There are other nice details in this film. The scene where Hoffman has to get the job at Christmas. It's only a few days before Christmas. He's an assistant. They're having their big party. Reminds me a little bit of The Apartment where they have a Christmas party. And he's willing to settle to make sure he has a job before the courtroom case starts in the early part of the new year. Also, when they're in the courtroom, the coats on the rail. Nice touch. It's New York. It's January. Where are coats going to go? I guess they have a coat room somewhere, but they just have them on the rail of the courtroom.
Yeah, what a nice authentic touch to just leave that set dressing.
A recurring line in this film is terrific. Hoffman says it, I think, 6 or 8 times. The last line of this film is terrific because Joanna asks Ted how she looks before she goes up to see Billy for, not the last time, but she's not going to take him away after all. The interesting thing about that is it wasn't even supposed to be in the movie. That was Streep asking a legit question of Hoffman. Maybe it was supposed to be of the director, but anyway, saying, so how do I look before we shoot this scene? He says, terrific, the elevator's closed, the movie's over. Out of context, that line isn't very good, but in context, as a line he said so often before, and now he's saying it to this person who's hurt him, who left him only 15 months before, it's a lovely ending quote.
She's also the person who gave him this gift of insight, introspection, and growth, intentionally or not. Perhaps there's an element of gratitude in him.
And a divorce case that ends up being better than a lot of divorce cases are in real life, for sure.
Oh, Mrs. Doubtfire. Yeah.
Mrs. Doubtfire is another one.
Probably the most far-fetched part of the film is that she just turns around at the end and is like, oh, you know what? Take him back,
see. He doesn't have the clouds on his wall, so I can't take him because he's already home. Although, my tears were welling up at E.T. levels.
Dude, I think I told you somebody was chopping onions about half the time of that film. It really moves me. It is very touching. Let's give credit to the child actor, like E.T., where so much of the success of that film really hinges on these incredible natural performers who are way too young to be that good at acting. Mm-hmm. And Justin Henry is incredible.
People have been talking a lot lately on podcasts I've been listening to about this year's Oscars and who was snubbed. More and more, and it's irrelevant now because he's not nominated, you're hearing about the kid from Room who wasn't nominated for supporting actor or leading actor. Another kid actor. Not a lot of times have kids ever been nominated. I just said E.T. Henry Thomas and Drew Barrymore. How in the world were they not nominated for the Oscar
Henry
in 1982?
Thomas. Yeah, especially. And Justin Henry was nominated. Mm-hmm. He was the youngest, still is the youngest ever nominee. He was 8 years old.
And he was up against the oldest ever winner, at least for supporting actor, Melvin Douglas, for being there. Sellers movie. Okay, so let's talk about the actors with a little more specifics here. Hoffman was in 4 AFI films. We covered The Graduate, Midnight Cowboy, All the President's Men, and Tootsie. Also, of course, Rain Man. So many other great titles he's got in his resume. Love him and Wag the Dog. This is nothing. Al Pacino and John Voight were talked about for this role. Would have been good in the film. I think they got lucky with using Hoffman. He was terrific, of course. Very gracious Oscar acceptance speech. I'll look for it online and hopefully get a link for the website to post there. He talks about how he's not better than Al Pacino or Peter Sellers, but this was his first of 2 Oscars. Of course, Rain Man was the other one. And Meryl Streep, who won for supporting actress, wouldn't have been considered for lead actress. But isn't it interesting that had she been, and the movie we're going to do in 2 weeks almost did this too, Only three times ever, we've talked about this a lot in our project, has a movie won the Big Five. Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, and for the screenplay. It happened one night, One Flew the Cuckoo's Nest, and The Silence of the Lambs. And yet Kramer vs. Kramer and American Beauty were extremely close to getting there. Kramer vs. Kramer didn't have a Best Actress nominee, and Streep wasn't in the movie enough to be the leading actress. Agreed. And American Beauty could have had that, and Annette Bening just didn't win, even though she was nominated for Best Actress. But it almost got there, and still it did win four of the Big Five, at least. And it did win Supporting Actress for Streep. So she was in The Deer Hunter the year before this, an AFI film, and Sophie's Choice, where she won the Oscar. So all three of those are acclaimed performances. They had talked about using Kate Jackson from Charlie's Angels in this role, and I guess she couldn't get out of that show.
Yeah, Erin Spelling wouldn't loosen up her schedule to let her do the film.
And then, of course, Jane Fonda, who was considered for everything back in this era, Goldie Hawn was also talked about. Streep was supposed to have played the Jo Beth Williams role.
Yeah, the one Jo Beth
Williams is the girlfriend, yeah.
Hilarious, hilarious scene.
And a little nudity in there, and Streep, I guess, was going to have to be nude, but then she ended up getting promoted. Her sadness in this role could be attributed to having lost John Cazale not long before.
We said
about how he was her boyfriend and he got cancer and was dying on the set of The Deer Hunter, which is the main reason she even took the role in The Deer Hunter in the first place. And then between that movie and this one, he did die. Streep was in Manhattan this same year with Woody Allen. She goes on to do these movies where she's got to play characters who are very clearly unhappy. And yeah, she probably could have played a comedy. She's a professional. She's a great actor. She could have forgotten about John Cazale to do her scenes. But it does give her some more authenticity that she's got to play someone who's so upset, so sad. The belated flower child in this film, as it turns out, using the fact that in her real life, this person she loved was just wasting away in front of her and then did die.
And one of the things that she always does well is elicit a lot of sympathy from the audience. You always feel a great deal of pathos for her when she is sad, you are sad. Good luck not being affected by that. And she was tasked with this near impossible job of making the audience sympathetic with the woman who abandoned this sensitive, sweet little boy.
I've abandoned my child! And that boy is Justin Henry. This was his film debut. He made no movies for 5 years. Don't know why, but then The Kid in The Shining. Also, Danny Lloyd did not make movies after that. And then Carrie Duffy in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. The same era, 2 years before this movie came out, in fact, did not make very many movies. So these talented actors, maybe not so much Danny Lloyd, but the other two could have gone into great careers and just didn't pursue that, I guess. Jane Alexander, who is the friend, she was in All the President's Men with Dustin Hoffman, and the only scene she has in that film is opposite Dustin Hoffman. That's all I'll say. And then she says more. And that's all I'll say. And then she says more again. We talked about Jo Beth Williams being the one-night stand, Poltergeist, The Big Chill. Another actress who didn't go very far after this, really in the kind of the way you thought she could have. She was a good-looking woman. She was good in all three of these movies, but didn't really have the kind of career that looked like she maybe was going to have. And Howard Duff is Shaughnessy, Ted Kramer's lawyer. Very authentic. He worked for 40-plus years, did more TV shows than movies. I liked his performance quite a lot.
There's no weak links in this chain. Everybody's absolutely excellent.
Mm-hmm. Directing all these people and also writing the screenplay, Robert Benton. He based it on Avery Corman's 1977 novel. Another example of a book that gets turned into a movie within a couple of years. We saw that so much on the Top 100 project. Benton also did Places in the Heart, which won some awards, including another writing award for him and an acting award for Sally Field. But his best movie, maybe including Kramer vs. Kramer, certainly right with Kramer vs. Kramer, is Nobody's Fool, with Paul Newman doing one of his best pieces of acting at the end of his career. Well, not the end, but close to the end of his career in 1994. Wonderful movie, and very fitting for this time of year because it's a winter set movie. Although here in Canada, we have no fucking snow, but it is a movie about cold. And
you say that as if you wish there were snow.
It's just so surprising to me.
And listen, it's surprising, but I am thoroughly okay with this.
Well, by the time we actually post this podcast, God knows we're going to be buried in snow. But as we record it, still none, really, this entire winter.
And incidentally, I've never seen Nobody's Fool.
You should watch that.
I should indeed, apparently.
We'll put it on our long list. There's a Francois Truffaut and Robert Benton connection in this film because Benton wrote Bonnie and Clyde with other people, but he was one of the writers on that. And that movie was meant, as was Kramer vs. Kramer originally, for Francois Truffaut. Truffaut never really got into English language films. He only ever did Fahrenheit 451 with an English cast, as I recall. An English language movie, I mean. Maybe he should have taken these other movies. Might have done great with them. His French movies were fantastic, and he could have done some excellent things in Hollywood, but just didn't do it.
I don't think anybody's going to complain that Truffaut's career was a disappointment in any way, but it was him that suggested to Benton that he direct the film himself. Mm. He was already writing the script, and he convinced him to do it himself.
Truffaut was acting in Close Encounters of the Third Kind a couple of years before this movie, actually, so he was making his mark in Hollywood that way. The producer, Stanley Jaffe, later did work on Fatal Attraction and The Accused, and if I'm not mistaken, He was a studio executive with Columbia Pictures, which made this movie too. And Martin Scorsese, when he was upset that the studio didn't want to let Taxi Driver go out the way he had edited it, the guy he wanted to do some damage to put it nicely, was Stanley Jaffe. But that's a story from my book that I've talked about lots in this podcast, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls. Maybe that's apocryphal, maybe it's not true at all.
Those three movies you named, Kramer vs. Kramer, Fatal Attraction, and The Accused, happen to be three movies that have notorious, amazing performances from their actresses. And two of the three won Oscars. Glenn Close didn't win for Fatal Attraction, but she might be the most iconic of those three, her playing Alex.
The one that the average person knows, even if they're not a big movie fan, they're going to know about that character more so than Jodie Foster, although the rape movie is pretty notorious too, I guess, isn't it?
And that's also an absolutely incredible performance. He must like making movies with complex, interesting female characters.
I think you got a point there. And Taxi Driver has one with a 12-year-old
definitely,
girl.
Definitely, yeah. And definitely against type. You know, she is not the typical prostitute.
Mm-hmm. Especially since she's 12 years old.
Yeah, no kidding.
Okay, well, KVK, technically speaking, is a 185:1 print. We watched the DVD. Looks pretty decent. The cinematographer, Nestor Almendros, who did shoot Days of Heaven and won an Oscar the year before this. And then Sophie's Choice for Alan J. Pakula, also, of course, starring Meryl Streep a few years after this one. Good cinematographer. The editor, Jerry Greenberg. Look at these credits. French Connection, Apocalypse Now, Kramer vs. Kramer. And he did other things, too, but those are red-letter films. And the music score, Vivaldi.
Yeah.
The legendary composer. And did you notice the street musicians are actually playing the theme? Early on.
I did notice that.
And then Henry Purcell also worked on the score. So a modern guy, along with Vivaldi, getting credit for the music.
But a nice, subtle score that is used sparsely and wisely.
All right, the influence from Kramer vs. Kramer is not enormous, but there's these. It was followed in 1980 by a fellow small movie, Robert Redford's Ordinary People, which also won its share of Oscars and acclaim, also beating out a more legendary movie in the long run, Apocalypse Now this year and Raging Bull in 1980. Awesome. People would say now those two movies should have won the Oscars, but Kramer vs. Kramer and Ordinary People took them down and were good choices at the time, and they're still good choices now, just not the right choice.
I really like Ordinary People. That's another movie that guts me. And it's another movie about, in a very different way, but a bad mom.
Yes, very true, and about a tough marriage. And Donald Sutherland, who's been good in a lot of films, was fantastic in that movie. He was never talked about as much as he should have been.
Yeah.
More influence from Kramer vs. Kramer. A lot of divorce or troubled marriage movies followed in the 1980s, and I mean a lot of them. Probably based on the fact that this movie won Oscars and was a gigantic hit. And the movie was remade in both Mexico and India.
Wow, really?
Mm-hmm.
I think divorce probably was a big part of popular culture at the time because there was just such an explosion of divorce in the 70s, and there was probably a lot of hand-wringing and think pieces about how that was going to affect all the children and the adults too, and marriages in the future, and nobody knew what the fallout for that was going to be. There's another movie you didn't mention, that's Mr. Mom, that probably got made because of the success of Kramer vs. Kramer.
Yeah.
Obviously very different tone, they are not divorced, but he is a father learning to take care of his children. That was a big favorite in my house growing up, we just loved that movie.
Okay, Kramer vs. Kramer has these AFI and awards credentials. It won 5 Oscars, Best Picture, Best Director for Benton, Best Actor for Hoffman, his first, Supporting Actress for Streep, her first, and the screenplay. The 4 failed nominations, Supporting Actor for Justin Henry, Supporting Actress for Jane Alexander, who plays the best friend, the editing by Greenberg, and the Almendros cinematography. The only AFI recognition was it was 3rd in the courtroom category of the top 100 genres.
So I forgot to mention when we talked about influence, I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, people like to use this as an example of when moviegoers were smarter. But I would say that this tone and this type of story has moved from the movie theater to cable television. This is the type of storyline that's just going to be much more likely to be done in a show like Mad Men.
Or even Breaking Bad, another AMC production. That's about a troubled marriage also. That doesn't end in divorce, but might as well have.
You know, once upon a time, people had to go to movie theaters to hear swear words, to see naked ladies, to see really complex stories play out. But now that that's something that's available on television, as a matter of fact, the popular movies are more juvenile and dumbed down and a little more childish. Whereas it's the cable dramas where you see the nudity and the intelligence and the really complex characters.
And it's also been said by so many people, and we talked about this when we did Star Wars and Jaws, that movies got downer because studios wanted to make Star Wars Part 2, 3, 4, 97, 120, as many as they possibly could, and make as much money as they possibly could. And yet, curiously, the Academy, just a few years after Star Wars and 4 years after Jaws, goes with this very simple movie, mostly on sets, and stages. Yeah, it's in New York outside, but not that much of it, really. Ordinary People, same kind of idea. And then Chariots of Fire, a small English movie the year after that. None of those movies are grand epics or big-scale, big-budget productions, and yet Star Wars and Jaws, well, they weren't huge budget productions, I guess, compared to what we see now. But that's the stereotype, and yet the Academy was kind of saying, no, that's not what we're going to reward. Maybe that's why Apocalypse Now didn't win out. Raging Bull's not a big-budget movie either. I don't know, I'm kind of fighting myself on this one. What was the right move here? Because those other two movies, of course, were legendary productions. Just like Chariots of Fire was overshadowed by Raiders at the box office, and certainly the movie that people care about now, E.T. in 1982 over Gandhi. The Academy rarely gets it right, according to a lot of people. I think they get it right, well, maybe half the time, a little more than half the time, I guess. But it's a strange era, isn't it? We're getting into blockbuster times, and yet blockbusters, when it comes to the big show... Well, this was a blockbuster, though, too. Yeah, oh, my God, I'm fighting myself constantly on this.
The Academy serves a strange purpose. It is rewarding a very specific kind of film. It always has, and it's always favored smart, grown-up dramas.
Not always favored.
Not always. Okay, always favored is always giving the advantage to movies like that. Now, mind you, I'm not going to sit here and argue that Apocalypse Now didn't deserve to win. In retrospect, it's really easy for all of us to say that Apocalypse Now was a more influential and enduring classic than Kramer vs. Kramer, but they're both great movies. I'm not sorry that Kramer vs. Kramer got rewarded because perhaps it helped save it from any kind of obscurity. Apocalypse Now did not need the Academy to be considered a classic now. Mm-hmm. Whereas Kramer vs. Kramer has been a little more forgotten. I think people our age are far less likely to have seen that than Apocalypse Now.
So having said that, would you have put this on the top 100 list?
Yeah, you know what I was thinking is I would replace Sophie's Choice. We said that Sophie's Choice is probably only on that list because of Meryl Streep's performance. I say, fine, you know what's a really easy replacement? Is this far superior film. And actually, in my opinion, a better performance. Maybe because she didn't have the challenge of the accent to go along with it. But her performance in Sophie's Choice is really all about one scene where I think that Kramer vs. Kramer, the whole film, her performance stands out.
Kramer vs. Kramer's big scene for her would be on the witness stand, and I was reading that she rewrote what was in the original screenplay to make it her own, and Benton said, you're a woman, write it the way a woman would speak this. And it works very well. Doesn't she? She convinces you.
Yeah, oh yeah. Benton has a real way with actors.
Well, then we'll have to watch Nobody's Fool, and you can see
Film
with a great actor and a good director guiding him through.
One of my favorite actors.
All right, we've talked a lot about the Oscars in this podcast, so that's fitting for next week's show. So on the February 22nd edition of the Next 100 Project, we're not going to review Braveheart, which was the original intention. Instead, in advance of the Oscars on February 28th, so mark that in your calendar, we'll do a preview show. In addition to discussing this year's awards, we'll get into Oscar history, and we'll talk about some of our favorite flicks of 2015. Dean. So the coming attraction trivia for the Oscar preview show. The TV ratings when Chris Rock hosted the Oscars in 2005 for the 2004 show, the Your Million Dollar Baby one, have only been surpassed once in the decade since, and only now is he coming back as a host. Isn't that interesting? What year was it, and who hosted that year?
Was it James Franco?
It was not James Franco. Spoiler alert, that's not the correct answer.
You just gave it away right there. All right, so for the answer to that question, please tune in to next week's podcast, our Oscar special. In the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. While you're there, please rate us and review us. We love it when you guys do that. Ryan and I can both be found on Twitter. I am at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. If you would like a more private way to reach us, please send us an email. Our address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. We always love to hear from you guys. And once more, I would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. How do you think the podcast went?
Terrific.
And cut.